I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. As a former commercial and ag banker, my main reason for doing this podcast is to simply gauge the market's appetite for crowdsourcing investment in a ranch real estate fund.
The Ranch Investor Podcast, curated by subject matter experts to give you immense benefit, because we believe your time is valuable.
Andy Ron.
Hi, Coulter. How are we doing?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's good to be back. To the show that you used to formerly co-host.
That's right. I haven't been on as many lately.
You've been busy.
Yeah, it's been a busy summer.
Growing your tech venture. You're a tech bro out of Billings, no longer Brozman, Montana.
Right. Yep. Trying to expand, bring on some new tech partners.
I want to talk about stigmatized properties today because I see in the news that the Zorro Ranch, Jeffrey Epstein's New Mexico ranch, just sold. And it made me think about those crazy people in South Carolina, the Murdos or the Murdochs. Do you remember that story about Alec Murdoch, Murdo, murdered his son and I think his wife, yeah, murdered his wife and his son, and then faked his own attempted murder. There's a Netflix documentary on it, so there's a huge backstory. But the thing is they had a bomb cool place in South Carolina, and that recently resold because he was in such financial troubles. I mean, that's usually the MO for murdering your wife or a 20-year-old girlfriend.
Right.
And he did not
comes
have,
hand in hand.
He didn't look like he had the 20-year-old girlfriend. So he did have the liabilities and the fraud going on. But that resold. Don't know what the price was, how that compares to quote unquote market. Same with Epstein's Zorro Ranch. That has sold. Don't know where that not disclosed price, but don't know how it compares with the quote unquote market down there in New Mexico. And I'm curious, what have you seen for stigmatized
properties? So when you messaged me about this topic today, I thought you just meant properties that were stigmatized because they were on the market too long, which happens in Montana. I didn't realize we were getting into murder and and fraud.
Well, there's probably degrees of stigmatization.
Well, isn't the classic example like in housing, right? Somebody dies in a house or right, or somebody's killed or there's a suicide in a house, right? Doesn't that broker have a stigmatized property to try to market?
Well, you just don't tell anyone about it.
Disclosure is...
You don't have to disclose that.
Isn't that...
No.
That's not minimum disclosure?
No, not in Montana.
Really?
No, you don't have to tell anyone that someone died and that's not adverse material information. Now, if they ask, obviously you can't be deceitful.
Right.
And I've been on a showing where it was just eerie. It was dark and smelled not like death, but it just smelled like an old house that hadn't been taken care of. And we're walking around and I'm not a superstitious person. I'm not even a little stitious. So I don't do the energies and the spirits and all that, but it gave me the chills and it gave my buyers the chills. And I asked the agent, I go, "Hey man, has someone died in here?" And he goes, "God, why'd you have to ask? Now I have to tell you, yeah, someone died in here."
Wow. See, there's something to it. Yeah. The neighborhood I used to live in Bozeman, there was a tragedy. A cop actually murdered his wife in front of his kids and himself, murdered his wife and killed himself, a cop in Bozeman, like, gosh, is this getting on 10 years ago? So that was in my neighborhood just down the street. And that house sold, you know, a year or two later. And when it was on the market, it seemed like it was on the market for a while too. You know, that was, Bozeman's almost always hot, you know, except for a few blips here and there, but you know, you made you wonder about this high profile, right? I mean, there's no way of not knowing that or.
Well, and almost the penultimate stigmatized properties would be Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. And that whole apartment complex was razed, I believe. I'm pretty sure that they put a park there.
Well, there's enough crazy in this world. You got to imagine there might be a premium in a small sector. You just got to find that that buyer segment, they would put a premium.
Well, yeah, there's those weird murder museums. Yeah. Those
serial
killer museums. But then Epstein's Island. I mean, we all kind of want to own an island.
Right, right.
What's it worth to you if you knew that Bill Clinton and the global elites had spent some time there?
With some underage
trafficked girls. Yeah, trafficked.
I took one of my appraisal training classes years ago, and it was very interesting because it was, most of my training is all land appraisal, but this class had machinery appraisals, jewelry appraisers, art appraisers. So, you know, broader spectrum. And there was an interesting art appraiser there from Chicago, and he was talking about Andy Warhol prints. And apparently an intern at some point had tried to shoot him. He was messing around with his interns, sleeping with his interns, and one of them got jaded and tried to shoot him. And this bullet went through a couple prints. He had some print racks. And those pieces of art are worth exponentially more because of the cultural, historical
story behind
it. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, you look at it from a nuts and bolts or, whatever. There's nothing inherent, you know, the art itself would not garner that price, but the bullet holes.
So what could be a stigma? So I've got this Warhol that is symbolic of sexual deviancy and having an affair or something. I mean, that could be one. It's art. It's up for interpretation.
Right.
But, so that story could work in your favor, that it's unique. It's ultra unique, highly unique. Or it's like, I don't like that so much. That's kind of a negative story. I don't want that. I don't want to enshrine that story in my house.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. Yes, you're asked the original question was stigmatized properties, and I don't feel like we've seen a lot of that in Montana. I mean, there's certain things like, I mean, we've had cults and we've had different things like that, you know, that own property,
right? And, yeah,
that then hits the market. I don't know that I can't really think of an example of like anything like approaching Epstein or Dahmer or, you know, anything like that. But I guess, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't realize we were going to murder and sexual deviancy, but. More typical in the market are things like, you know, I thought you were angling at, you know, overpriced properties that languish on the market for years and years, or overbuilt properties, or things like that. A little more tame in the stigmatization.
How can you say so? Can you put a value on stigma?
Well, I've wanted to try to come up with a standard for what you could characterize as overpriced. And of course, part of the difficulties there, you don't know it's overpriced till the time passes, but you know, if something's on the market for 3 years at a price, it's pretty good evidence that it's overpriced, you know, and because that's longer than the typical marketing exposure period in the market. And we see that a lot. I mean, there are properties on the market that have been on the market for 10 years.
Well, the IX Ranch just sold.
The IX Ranch just sold. That's one of the more infamous.
That was the longest listing in U.S. history.
Almost, yeah, about 10 years.
And I mean, that thing just proved right. Leave it on the market long enough and inflation in the market will catch up to the price you want.
Yeah. I mean, that does seem to be a strategy. But yeah, I mean, like a lot of things, it's hard to prove or hard to come up with, you know, statistically verifiable like evidence in the market, but of course a lot of it's anecdotal. But you know, the classic scenario is overpricing a property, and I think it's especially bad in a hot market, because in a hot market everybody expects things to move. If the property's priced right, if the value is there, if it's a, you know, if it's worth trading, it's going to trade. But now here's a property, everything else is, you know, traded in a short amount of time. Here's a property that's outside the typical time zone. And I do think buyers smell that and say, okay, wait a minute, what's wrong?
Well, they do, but it sounds to me like you are talking about a stagnating listing rather than a stigmatized. Stagnation to me is, yeah, you got this one out there. It's got a high price. Everyone knows it.
But isn't that the result? Doesn't it then become stigmatized in the market? The buyers?
Sure. Yeah. The buyers would say we tend to believe that, if the price is shit and they're not moving on it, that either the seller is shit or the ranch is shit. There's a reason that it's not moving, and it's at that price, and it's either a shitty seller or a shitty ranch.
So then I think they're motivated. Then there's an inherent motivation to offer lower than they maybe otherwise would. Here's a property that's been on the market too long. Clearly that market price isn't being verified, validated by the market. So I'm going to come in lower. So is that a strategy that harms the buyer the seller? Or if the seller went higher than they should have or higher the market in the first place, does that work out well for them? I guess it depends on the details, but
yeah, there's research. I believe there's university research about the cost, the real economic cost of overpricing a listing.
Yes. Well, time value of money, that seems to be one that gets lost on a lot of sellers.
Certainly. Yeah, they have, especially ranches where they've been on it their whole life.
Yep.
There is no time value of money, just like there's no opportunity cost.
Certain economic principles just
don't apply. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've talked about this on the podcast before, sellers and expectations and no accounting for time value of money. That's such a large asset, such a once in a lifetime asset kind of deal. They just tend to throw rules and economic principles out the window, and treat it, you know, like a different category than any other economic entity.
Well, as my father would say, when I took on his listing, much to my chagrin, and we were significantly overpriced by my professional opinion, which your children, and in particular your son's professional opinion, means shit to you.
Yeah, yeah. I think Dave Ramsey calls that the
powdered butt syndrome.
That's right. He powdered your butt back in the day.
That's right.
You don't have much to contribute.
he's like, well, you only get to sell it once.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely the kind of the baseline mentality, is you only get one shot at creating all that wealth and capital.
Right.
Or creating realization of that capital.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what comes to my mind. If you're going to talk about the broad Montana market and stigmatization of properties, that's what comes to my mind, is overpricing and being on the market longer than would be expected, and that creating some stigma. We've talked about over-improvement. I don't know if that quite qualifies as a stigmatization, but I guess if you're going to define stigmatization broadly as, you know, negative impacts on a property and its time on market and whatnot.
Well, sounds to me like it's a spectrum. Stigma is a spectrum, and probably the most benign would be overpricing it. And then as you move further into material influence or material effect, I should say, it would be overbuilt. That's not quite as bad as Jeffrey Epstein having the Prince of England out there.
The former US, the president and the Prince of England.
Yeah,
and
Prince something. I don't care about the monarch and royalty. Like, we kind of got rid of that too. But I know there's one. He has a name.
They're out there somewhere.
Yeah, he has a name. He's been removed from the family, I hear. But
really?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Prince Andrew, isn't it?
Prince Andrew, yes. Yeah. So anyways, we got overpricing, not that bad. Then the overbuilt, was that the next one?
Yeah, over-improved.
Over-improved, and then if you move into, you know, Dahmer's apartment or Epstein's Island or Epstein's Ranch, why we're talking about this is Zorro Ranch. Mm-hmm. Those seem like more severe discounts because you're limiting your market. Each way through this spectrum, your market becomes smaller and smaller. So there's only so many people who are willing to buy your ranch with 12 bedrooms.
And we need to start with the premise that it's a pretty small market to begin with.
Correct.
I mean, I think sometimes people underestimate that. So it's a small market to begin with. And, you know, I'm trying to think. I can't think of a property that I've ever heard of or remember hearing about in Montana that you know, like an Epstein property or whatnot that was stigmatized. And, you know, again, there's been some like the cult stuff, like Church Universal Triumphant had lands, some of which they've sold and stuff like that. But I think any of this, who knows, even with the Epstein, I mean, do you think there really is a stigma, or do you think someone can come along and just say, well, you know, that was a funky history, but you know, I can rewrite the history on this place. And
I do think that you can rebrand a place.
I mean, I don't know that it would put me off. I mean, if I was shopping for an island and could afford it, and you know, in some ways, actually, I might embrace like, well, I'm going to do something better.
Spin. Yeah. It's a spin. You would need a PR person to spin the story in your favor and say, I'm going to come into the Zorro Ranch and we're going to bring veterans out here and we're going to have this feel good mission.
I was going to say, if you're planning on picking up girls in town and bringing them to your ranch, that might not be the place. You might have to,
you wouldn't want to have a recovery ranch for teenage troubled girls. No,
right.
Like I don't think that's going to work. Montana has a few of those for troubled teens ranches.
Yeah. Although there's another angle on stigmatization. That whole thing has been called into question. There was legislation in the last session on that for abuse, some abuses, some lawsuits and accusation of unregulated. They were highly unregulated in Montana and some criticism of that.
Well, going back to, you can rebrand a place, but it depends on use, what you're going to use it for. Because if you were to buy Epstein's Island and put your best foot forward on a PR campaign and spin it, put it in the old Washington, D.C. spin cycle that, oh, we're going to completely twist the words in the meaning of what's actually happened here. We're going to completely manipulate this messaging to make us look virtuous, to make us look altruistic. You could do that, but if you're going to have, well, if you're going to have a kid's summer camp out there, if the use is going to be a children's summer camp, that probably ain't going to work. But if it's your family private retreat, for you and a few friends, maybe even, it's probably not that bad.
And sometimes there's a novelty premium. Like, what about Ted Szyszynski, the Unabomber? Like, I don't know what happened to his little place. But didn't this cabin get sold or donated to a museum or something? There was something about that recently. Because he died, you know, this summer, I think.
Yeah, he hung himself in prison.
Did he?
I'm pretty sure. We need a fact checker here.
I don't know about that. That's going a little far.
I'm pretty sure I thought he hung himself.
I thought he died of cancer. I thought he aged out. But yeah, you know, there's also a novelty thing, right? Historic. Well, that's the bullet hole in the Warhol prints. But you know, that it can go both ways.
I would pay a premium for the Freeman's Ranch in Garfield County. My people, man. Yeah.
Your forefathers.
No lock gates on that one. Everyone's welcome to come experience the beauty of sovereignty and vigilantism.
Yeah. Yeah. But I haven't seen that be much of a factor in the Montana land market. I mean, we haven't had a, you know, some kind of super, super dark. Well, it's funny though. I'm thinking back, like, I remember when I was a kid, there were rumors of like Satan worshipers outside of town in Helena. Like there was a property that catered to that or had a group like that or something. And I can remember hearing rumors like that as a kid. I never saw any of that play forward into, you know, land transaction stigmatization. But
going back to a ranch, I would suspect that the bottom, I mean, and I kind of think that Epstein's story is just so horrific. I'm not sure you could spin cycle that away. Right. I don't think you could PR campaign that out, that terrible history. So, but there is a baseline value to me, and I would say that's grazing. So if it's going to sell for, say, the cattleman who does not care, he'd be like, well, every other ranch in this area is priced at $14,000 an animal unit. Oh, I'll throw in a bid at $8,000 an animal unit.
Didn't Dennis Washington buy the Oregon cult property?
Yeah. From the Rajneeshkis?
Yeah. So there was a property that some shifty stuff went down on, and he came and bought it as a ranch, right? He just turned it back into a ranch.
Yeah. Well, now you bring up a point that stigma is subjective. because I think that's cool. I would love to own a ranch that those crazy Rajneeshkis tried to start their own nation on.
Yeah.
I think that's a cool story. And I would gladly, so that's the thing, is subjectively, I would gladly tell that story. Like, hey, I bought this 65,000 acre ranch from those crazy Rajneeshkis.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people, and I'm guessing Dennis Washington, yeah, like putting an end to a story that, you know, most people, a lot of people, particularly in that neighborhood, I'm guessing. I mean, I saw the Netflix special, you know, the neighbors weren't happy about that whole, you know, that was a disruption to the neighborhood, a disruption to the culture. So it's like, it's almost like, what's the word I'm looking for? Restorative or something. Like, it's bringing it back. It had a crazy chapter,
right,
in its arc of history, and we're bringing it back. We're normalizing this.
You weren't on the podcast when Rich Bradbury, who's a rancher out there in Eastern Oregon, he came on. He was in here. He came out from Oregon, and he talked about, he grew up around the Rajneeshkis. And, you know, in Eastern Oregon, it's a lot like Eastern Montana. It's 50 miles to the next town of 80 people. And so, you know, everyone pretty dang good. And it, you know, the Rajneeshkis legitimately conducted biological terrorism.
Yeah.
And he was there, part of that.
You know, I lived in Paradise Valley 20 years ago. It was kind of at the tail end of the Church Universal Triumphant era. But that, you know, it's funny, even growing up in Billings, I don't know, I guess you're probably too young for this. But like when I was a kid growing up, I mean, the Church Universal Triumphant, that was big news. And we went to Chico a lot. My family went to Chico a lot. So we kind of had this, you know, attachment or whatever to the Paradise Valley. So it was news, you know. And then I moved back from school in Northern California back to Montana, and was renting from church people in Paradise Valley. And it was the last throes of that whole thing. But, and they're, you know, they had their compound, but then they had these subdivisions, which are of course still there. They don't go away, but Glastonbury North, Glastonbury South. So these subdivisions full of 10 and 20 acre tracts that were populated by people that were part of the church, but the church fell apart, or, you know, greatly, it's still there, but greatly diminished. And, you know, some of these properties had, you know, bunkers and so bomb shelters and a stockpiling of arms and munitions were part of that cult. But I don't think any of those properties really suffered from stigmatization. I mean, when they started to sell, and when that became not a cut project or property, and since then, right, people have just been buying and taking those over. I don't remember any stigmatization. You know, people didn't seem to be worried about that.
So you're telling me that there is a ranch in the Paradise Valley with a bunch of sheep followers, congregation, that has stockpiled weapons and bunkers, and they are in desperate need of a new cult leader? This sounds too good to be.
you're seeing an opportunity. Yeah, Elizabeth Clare Prophet was the, and she has since passed. The church is still there. They, you know, they opened that new hot springs down there. That Yellowstone Hot Springs is owned by.
That's them.
Yeah, that's Church Universal Triumphant. Oh. So they're still there. They're much, much, much diminished from their height and glory. But yeah, you know, they had some dramas. They had some diesel tanks leak, underground diesel tanks leak, because they were stockpiling diesel and leaked into the aquifers. And then they wanted to drill into some of that. You know, there's so much hydro activity. I mean, it's just north of Yellowstone Park. So they started to, and I feel like they did. I feel like they started to tap some geothermal, and the feds had to shut them down. I mean, they were worried about, like, maybe that causing Old Faithful not to go, you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, they definitely had some dramas. Her husband, I want to say, and yeah, when I was a kid, so this was in the 80s, he was busted in Seattle buying 50 caliber automatic, I think it was, machine guns and stuff like that. And stockpiling those back at the compound. So,
oh man,
yeah,
mismanagement sounds like an opportunity for a turnaround guy, a new CEO, aka cult leader.
Yeah, yeah. But so anyway, those are a bunch of properties that potentially you would think might be stigmatized, but I just don't think they were. I just think people thought, well, because I knew people that bought, you know, well, you know, for one thing, there's always been kind of a short, I mean, you know, there's not that much housing and small tracts and stuff in that valley. I mean, you know, it's been happening over time.
Like you as the appraiser, if the courts, the government stepped in, assigned the ranch to a special master, he was in charge of marketing it for them not paying their taxes, and he asked you to do an appraisal, it sounds to me like you're not going to put a discount on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You're reminding me where I've come into situations where you just have to evaluate. Is there something unique going on? Is there market influence, market interference, even, like, right? Like, is there something going on in this special case? I mean, sometimes it can just be a matter of volume. And I wasn't an appraiser when I lived out there, but my memory of it is that the church was in, you know, kind of falling apart, and a lot of people were moving out because this church attracted people from all over the world. I think the church, I want to say they started in Europe maybe, and then they were headquartered in California, and she moved from California, the coast of California, to Paradise Valley because California was going to fall into the ocean from the San Andreas Fault, and Paradise Valley was going to be oceanfront property, I believe.
Oh, every cult leader sells a doom and gloom story. Yeah. And then they every shepherd has to isolate his sheep.
The irony about that is because then I studied geology and geomorphology in school, and the Paradise Valley, if you're worried about geologic scale disaster, you know, Yellowstone reactivating and sending lava flows and mud flows down the Paradise Valley is as likely as California falling into the ocean. So she just went from one geologic, you know, vulnerability spot to another. But my memory at that time was that a lot of these tracks were put on the market because people were pulling up and leaving them. So there might've been a bit of a saturation. So as an appraiser coming in, it's like, well, you know, a whole bunch of lots are hitting the market at a higher rate than has been in the past, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know that there was any kind of, because I don't know if properties were like turned over in bankruptcy or anything like that. Because I think they were individually owned. I mean, that was kind of counter to how that, in general, the way that cult operated was you gave all your assets.
Hell yeah,
to the,
you do.
To the church.
That's a good cult. You get them in and take everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So they can't leave you.
I might have it wrong about those tracts, whether they were owned by the church or individual. I feel like they were owned by individuals, even though that doesn't seem to fit the... But maybe it was overflow, you know, people that couldn't live on the main compound for lack of space or whatever, they, you know, had these outside subdivisions. But my memory is they just hit the market and that they were received generally pretty positively. I mean, I knew some people that bought in there, but actually now that I'm thinking it through a little bit, I think maybe it's because they were cheap. They were affordable. So maybe
why were they cheap and affordable?
Yeah. Right. So maybe there was some, you know, it's funny. The gal that I know that bought up there, I was the gardener at Chico Hot Springs 25 years ago or whatever, retrofitted the greenhouse to use the geothermal and stuff. And the gal that was my assistant, her and her husband and her family, they bought a tract up there. So, and I know a few others too, so maybe I should circle back but yeah, they were affordable. I mean, part of it was they were up in the hills. They were sort of
hard to physically access.
Yeah. They had rough physical access. They weren't, I mean, you know, stuff down in the valley closer to the river and on nice, you know, irrigated cropland was more premium.
You're giving me an exact, an anecdotal example. I'm curious about a market analysis and how you could actually price the perceived discount or the perceived loss of value into this, if there's some sort of normalization to negative feelings, generally negative feelings around a certain property.
Yeah, well, that's the trick as an appraiser. I mean, you have to find the smoking gun. You know, you have to find market evidence, which can be tough to do. But presumably, like in that situation, you know, those tracks were lower, you know, trading at a lower rate than, you know, maybe other parts of the valley. And so was that because of the sort of ownership dynamic? Was there some sort of stigmatization? Is it just location and access? You know, you got to tease all those things out. And a lot of times, you know, you don't have a hard answer. A lot of times it's like, well, it's kind of a combo of all the above, you know? And you know, you don't have to come up with the perfect name for it. You can just say, well, these are discounted properties. I mean, the evidence shows they trade at X percent of tracks elsewhere.
And we're certainly not seeing a negative stigma with Yellowstone erupting. People don't seem to be concerned that the world's largest volcano that will immediately wipe out Bozeman.
You know, it's funny, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, there was an elevation line that she you know, she was a prophet to her own
by self-declared.
Yes. And there was an elevation that her followers were not allowed to live below. And I knew a woman who lived, she was excommunicated from the church because she lived below the required elevation and she was going to be wiped out by ocean water, I think was what Elizabeth Clare Prophet claimed.
There's always some really good bullshit story.
I mean, are we within 1,000 miles of the ocean? 800 miles, 700 miles, something like that.
We're closest to what, Seattle?
Yeah, that's a lot of seawater to come our way.
That's a pretty big tidal wave. Yeah, I don't know. It would take a big one to send that to go surfing in Billings.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if this is off topic, but I mean, it's what comes to my mind because you started talking about market analysis, and I've done a lot of market analysis. That a classic scenario is appraising a ranch and maybe there's a particular request from the client to analyze development potential. So the classic scenario is like ranch, well, we think, you know, geez, we could sell off some tracks or we could take 600 of these acres and chop it up and we'd hate to leave that money on the table kind of deal. So then they hire me to sort of do a market study of tracks. And I'm often surprised how low the absorption rate is when I roll up my sleeves on that.
On a rural subdivision?
Yeah. Yeah.
To 100%?
Yeah. So it's like you do your research and you find out, okay, two or three of these type tracks sell a year. And that's in a pretty hot market. So now this ranch family is thinking about creating dozens of those and putting them on the market, and they're going to be in competition with those two or three that two to three sell, and you know there's probably three times that many or two three times that many on the market, right? So you're in competition with that for that small pie, and you just do those calculations and you say, well, okay, you know, in 20 years you can probably get this sucker sold out.
Yeah, that is a long absorption rate. And that's definitely what we see with rural subdivisions.
But a lot of landowners think, oh, I see some, you know, boy, it's, you know, people are moving in here and wanting housing and this and that. So, you know, boy, we can just do this and snap our fingers and we're going to get four times the ag rate, you know, or whatnot.
Yeah.
But then you tell them, well, okay, you're going to be you got to be a developer. I mean, you know, you got to do the development stuff. That's time and money and planning.
There's
and
costs effort, into it.
Costs into it. And then you're going to do this whole thing and you're going to watch it, you know, take 20 years. And by the way, that's going to ebb and flow pretty dramatically, right? We're going to have years like 2021 where you'll sell twice as many as you expect. And then there'll be slow years where nothing sells. So, I mean, it's a little off topic as far as stigmatization, but there's a lot of underappreciation for factors like that. And even myself, you know, when I roll up my sleeves and do those projects, I've been surprised a number of times, like, wow, I mean, I've done stuff along the Yellowstone River here, you know, Billings and Laurel and Park City. And you think, well, the Yellowstone River tracks, like that's pretty premium, right? Who doesn't want a nice track on the Yellowstone? It's like, well, there's only a couple a year that tend to sell, you know?
All right. Give situational analysis. Talking about stigmatization and influences on that value. Say I am a landowner and I had a disagreement with my neighbor years ago and
that doesn't sound like you.
This is not a real example. I have plenty of those.
This one's asking me to stretch my imagination right now.
This was completely fabricated. I can give you anecdotes off the record.
I can give you anecdotes.
You're talking about the mask mandate thing?
Any number.
there's a few. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So him and I never mended our fences, and I go to sell this and he wants to spite me, or she, and he puts up a big red sign with white lettering next to my driveway. And it says, I am an asshole and you're not going to get along with me. I am a terrible neighbor.
Hmm. Yeah. Well,
you're going to drive out there for your appraisal and you're going to do what?
Yeah. Well, even a more realistic example is like the, you know, those shithole property, like a really trashed. Like, I remember I worked for a client that bought a really nice property in the Whitehall area. And Whitehall area, you know, Whitehall used to be the joke. It's suburb of Butte. So there's a fair kind of working class.
Very
redneck.
Mining.
Yeah, yep. Right. Mining, working class, redneck. And, you know, there was one of these properties that was just a shithole. It was just a trash accumulator. I mean, the guy literally had God knows how many burnt out trailers and, I mean, junk. Like a junkyard, like a private junkyard. Just looked like shit, right? Right next to this property that was they were restoring, you know, Spring Creek fisheries on this place. They were going for, you know, we were talking about Paradise Valley Chico, you know, on the way to Chico, there used to be the Ted Mosier place that was that.
I do recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, in the end, I don't think Chico had to do anything. I think it was bought, you know, by someone else and they cleaned it up. But I know there were times where Chico was like, tried to buy, you know.
I didn't know that you knew the guy's exact name. I just recall when I was younger, driving by to beautiful Chico and all of these out-of-staters, tourists in the Paradise Valley. And this dude had a
junkyard.
I think he had a single wide upside down.
Oh, yeah.
I think he flipped one up.
Well, I knew him by name because I lived out there. And, you know, out there they have, you know, dump stations, right? You take your trash to a dump station and you'd show up to be dropping off your trash and Tom Mosier was there picking stuff up.
I did not know that backstory, but I did think that guy's a badass.
Well, and because I worked for Chico and knew the owners and stuff, and that's coming back to me. I mean, I think they, and I'm sure other neighbors too, right? Like tried to talk to the county committee, you know, tried to do stuff, but
tried to take his private property rights away.
You have a right. You have a right to trash your property. I mean, you know, to accumulate junk on your property. There's no, there's no way to prevent that or no basis to prevent that. Yeah.
So who's the arbiter of what junk is? Who's to say what's junk?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, as an appraiser, I mean, I can't say that I've ever, I mean, that was a consulting thing that I've been talking about in Whitehall. So I don't think do an actual appraisal, but that could be a tough thing. It's like, okay, I'm appraising this property. It's next door to, I mean, well, I did do a consulting job on properties adjoining, gravel pits because I did this for a client who had a beautiful property in Gallatin Gateway and a gravel pit opened up next to her. And, for a lot of it for her was just quality of life. I mean, they were going round the clock and running those, you know, the mandated backup beepers on these massive pieces of machinery.
Yeah.
So like the dust, the noise, all this kind of stuff.
The OSHA beepers on your heavy equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is interesting. She had no relief with legal channels or like with the county or, you know, anything like that. And I was kind of somewhat of a last resort, if I recall, you know, get an appraiser to do a property diminution analysis and take that to the county commissioners, or it wasn't the commissioners, it was a committee of some kind, it was a board of some kind. They were kind of like, I think their stance was, well, you know, we can't do anything without some sort of verifiable impact, And she hired me, and I was able to document an impact for studying properties adjacent. And when I took that to that board, they said, okay, now we got something to work with. And I don't remember what they worked out, but the landowner was ecstatic because she'd been dealing with this with years, getting nowhere. But you know, that was a challenging project because it was a mix. There were properties that, I mean, there was one great, really nice property sold next to a gravel mine, and the guy didn't give a damn. He was kind of he had an industrial background. He's like, I like this stuff. I like big machines.
It's very subjective.
It's very subjective. But to your original question though, if you're adjoining a property that has an issue, there's a term for that. There's an appraisal term for that. It's not externality, but when the environment, there's something in the environment, there's something outside of your property affecting your property, essentially a neighboring property. And I mean, without a doubt, that can be real. Again, especially in Montana, where aesthetics and quality of life and all these things tend to be a backbone of the market, you know?
Yeah, depends on the market. I mean, how desperate someone is to move to Bozeman at that time.
Yeah.
I still think, wouldn't you believe, or am I not far off in thinking that, like with the Zorro Ranch, Epstein, kind of the baseline value is going to be cattlemen. It's like if no one else wants, which it sold, someone bought it.
Yeah.
But if it's not going, I don't know what New Mexico that place was doing, let's say $500 an acre. If that was what the neighboring places were going for and they couldn't get it, I would think that $300 an acre for the cattlemen is what they were paying. And that's like, all right, I'll graze this. I'm not proud of the story on that side of the ranch where that big lodge is, but, you know, this is cheap grass. This is good for my bottom line.
Well, yeah, the stigmatization probably didn't diminish the baseline value, but any kind of like, you know, because he obviously improved the property and tried to create a different highest and best use as kind of an executive retreat.
Yes.
Type yeah. place. Yeah. Full value of that development is probably impacted. If it was not Epstein, right? If it was, you know, Bill Gates or something.
He was there, I'm sure.
Yeah. Right. But if it was a neutral, so to speak, or right, like somebody that didn't have a stigma attached to, you know, how he lived his life and what he was, you know, convicted of, or I guess he never got convicted, but then maybe that highest and best use, that upgraded, that developed highest and best use would be realized, and perhaps not in this case.
Okay. I would, right? I buy that. You've earned your appraisal fee.
Am I in compliance? Was that USPAP compliant?
I'm not going to dicker too much with you on your fee now. All right. 15 minutes left. What's going on? Today's the end of August.
Yeah.
What's going on in the ranch market?
You know, I just had a conversation with this morning. Who's our buddy, Chris Payton? Is that his name? With the Progressive Farmer?
Yeah. Yeah. Chris. So the chief policy editor with
yes.
Progressive Farmer Magazine Media, Progressive yep. Farmer,
yep.
Progressive Farmer Media.
Both you and I talked to him earlier this summer, and he said he's getting his article put together and wanted one last conversation. And I had this conversation this morning, and I keep imagining a visualization or something that I would be able to put on Montana Land Source, but I'm going to take a whack at this. So imagine there's a straight line graph with quality of property and price in the market, right?
And price is the x-axis and quality is the y.
Yeah, and just let's just say for sake of simplicity, it's a straight line. It's a linear relationship. Like higher quality properties, you know, get a higher premium, and it goes down from there, right?
Yes.
And just say that line is at some kind of an angle. I think in the Montana land market, when the market is hot, when the market is up, that, well, you could say that whole line goes up, but obviously, but it gets more level. The bottom end is what really gets lifted. And you know, I mean, the whole line gets lifted. But then times like right now, which is, you know, it's, we're not experiencing a crash, but we're experiencing a correction to be sure. But it doesn't seem to be affecting the top tier properties. Top tier properties seem to be trading as strong as ever. So but the bottom end is what's really, because if you look at Montana Land Source at the stats that are on there now, you know, on a across the state average or median basis, prices are down. But I don't think that affects every segment of the market. I don't feel comfortable saying that the market overall is, because we're seeing some pretty high sales on particularly the top properties.
So are you saying it becomes a, rather than linear, it becomes a U curve?
I don't know. I'm not even talking about the curve. I'm talking about the pitch. I'm talking about the angle. The bottom end drops.
Okay.
And it's almost like you could put a pin in the
top. So it's a steeper slope.
Yep. And I really think the B and C and D and below properties are what are more volatile. Those rise. And I mean, it makes sense. You know, the good stuff always sells. The good stuff always does well. And a big part of that is there's a shortage of that. There's always a shortage of top properties. So even in the worst parts of the market cycle, you know, a truly special property comes up, it's likely to sell at a good price, right? So that top stays preserved.
Okay, so the slope is getting steeper, meaning the A properties are receiving a higher premium.
Yep, and the less than A properties are receiving lower premiums. And you know, like in, if you watch my weekly reports, we're seeing a lot more price reductions than typical. So that's reflecting this correction market. But I think those price corrections are, you know, I don't want to say subpar properties, but not A plus properties, right?
In their own minds, they are.
Yeah, right.
They're not even on the USDA grading scale. They're not prime. They're on the Japanese A5. This is right. An A5 Wagyu ranch.
But it's kind of interesting because in general, and I rail about this a lot because it just seems like sellers in Montana often are pretty unreasonable and unrealistic and have high expectations. We've talked about this a lot. But clearly, there is some recognition because there are price reductions. So I don't, you know, I guess I'm guessing that that's brokers successfully communicating with their clients that,
well, that's a hard one, is to go tell someone that they have a B grade property.
Yeah.
Oh, you just insulted their.
Right.
Being.
Well, yep. And then you got guys like me that are hedging against saying that the market is down or correcting because it's not true across all sectors. And then landowners pick up on that.
Yeah. Well, prices are down, but not for my ranch.
right. But I've been thinking about that visualization. I keep imagining, you know, some kind of a active visualization that shows the pitch of that line in a different. That's how I'm starting to see the Montana land market is. I mean, that line goes up uniformly because, you know, land appreciates in Montana almost always, but then the pitch changes. And I think when the market's hotter, it becomes more level. And the other way I think about it is like a water level rising, right? Like a water level in a bay or something, or in a marina, right? Like rises all boats. So in hot market times, all the boats rise, right?
Yeah.
But then when we get into correction and into more sort of normal market cycles, we see that a differentiation in the market where, and again, the top of the market always does well, always seems to appreciate, and the less than prime properties are more dramatically affected.
High tide floats all boats.
Yep. So that's what I think we're in a correction period. It's funny. I've characterized it often, like in my weekly reports, I've called it a pencil sharpening, that the buyers are sharpening their pencil. But I talked to a broker the other day and he said, I don't know how sharp the pencils are. Because they were talking about some cell they were part of that they actually thought was pretty strong, pretty high.
On the IX ranch.
Not
on. You know what's funny about me saying that is I'm wrong, because that ranch sold for a price, presumably for a price that the consensus, the majority of us out there said, oh, that'll never happen. They're never going to get it. It's been on the market for 10 plus years. It's just going to stay on the market longer until inflation continues to drive up the market around it. But we are wrong. It actually achieved some sort of premium. And so that it probably will. What I'm trying to get at, Andy, is I think my rationale and my reasoning is therefore it will again. If one man pays a premium, another man will pay a premium.
Well, and it's, you know, we need to circle back around with the brokers involved, because that property would could possibly be a case study in stigmatization, because it was on the market for so long. And not everybody realizes, but like when it first hit the market, there was a C Corp involved, which is problematic. And that, so that was
operating assets.
Yep. So that explains part of the problem. So that, I overlay this interpretation that that's what, you know, kept it, potentially kept it from selling for a certain period of time. And then, you know, my understanding of that ranch was that the owners, excuse me, wanted to stay on the place, wanted to manage the place. So it was, I don't know that it was a standard offering. There were, there were conditions and issues on the offering.
Kind of like that were private unique. Equity. It wasn't a ranch sale, it was a private equity deal.
Yeah. So I think that was part of the issue. And best I know, you know, eventually over time that property became more of what you would call a standard listing. Like, no, it's for sale and you take it all when you buy it kind of thing. So that could be a case study and factors, because that's, you know, those things I outlined were stigmatization factors in a market, because most people that buy multi-billion dollar ranches want to own it outright and run it as they see fit.
Right. So my assumption with the limited knowledge I have around that and what you just said is that that wasn't valued based on a comp sale. It was more of a discounted future cash flow as a cap rate. Because if you're buying management and the operating assets with it, you're not selling land. You're selling an enterprise.
Not right. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm speaking a little bit out of speculation, but I think that was the case, that it was more complicated, at least initially when it was first on the market.
We're fully allowed to talk shit and speculate on this podcast.
All right. That's why we don't have fact checkers
or sponsors. Can't cancel me.
Yeah. We prize our independence.
Well, that is interesting. And I kind of think for these bigger ranches, that is the future. I think they do sell as an operating unit.
Well, and then, I mean, just getting back to the stigmatization issue, I mean, that's the problem. So like, you know, maybe the ranch when it was initially offered, you know, just wasn't conforming to the market in terms of being a pure offering, right? It had operational issue, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, that took a couple of years to sort of, but now it's been on the market for a couple of years, and not everybody has that backstory, and not everybody, you know, and I do think you create a situation where, like, right? I mean, if you're representing a buyer, and let's say the IX, you know, it's that kind of buyer, potentially fits that buyer, and you take it to him, isn't one of the first, you know, as you're sharing information, and if once you share that information, oh yeah, this thing's been on the market 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. Don't you think then right away that buyer says, well, now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Let's talk more about that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What am I missing here? What the hell's wrong with it?
Because you know, no one else has been willing to buy it. So, I mean, I think that really spooks.
There's more to people. The story I have to do due diligence on now. You're making my job harder.
And isn't the other end of the spectrum on that, as far as a sales perspective, hey, I got this deal. It hasn't hit the market yet. You know, you're the first to know about it. We got to move fast.
I don't do pressure sales, Andy.
But doesn't that psychologically...
I don't hog listings either.
Doesn't that psychologically get people excited? Oh, there's a unique opportunity. I gotta act quick and decisively, because, you know, versus, you know, clearly this is not a ranch that's been on the market for a couple of years. Clearly that's not the case.
Well, I would say you're doing... If whoever you're pitching that pre-market opportunity to, if it checks all the boxes, then I think you're doing your job. You're doing a good job. You're providing exceptional service. But if you're just pitching them bullshit like, hey, you're going to be first in line.
Yeah.
That's worth something, huh? You're first look to you.
Well, you know, I look at like Facebook Marketplace sometimes to buy something, right? And something comes along and it's like, ooh, that just hit yesterday or hit this week. And there's this feeling like, oh boy, if I'm interested in that, maybe I should move. But if I see, you know, they tell you how long it's been on the market there too. And if, you know, you see, oh, 3 months, 2 or 3 months, you're like, oh, I don't, you know, right. No rush here.
Yeah.
And in fact, I might want to really think hard about price, you know. Well, now I got to start thinking about how much lower I'm going to offer, because clearly if it was worth that, it would have gone.
Oh, that bit me in the ass several times in 2020 and 2021.
Yeah.
Because I didn't believe that the market we were in was real. And I was going from the old school 2019 prior, that these listings on the market, and I had a few of them myself, that had been on the market for quite a while, that they were just going to stay on the market until there was a price reduction. But I missed out on millions of dollars of sales because there was no sense of urgency. There was no rush given history, but we did not know what we were in the middle of at that time.
Right. Yeah, it really was something. I mean, you remember I got in trouble for early in that deal, putting out a little bit of a blog saying that it might be slow, that uncertainty, you know, larger economic uncertainties can harm our market. That was the potential downside.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I was right up until summer of 2020, right? Cause the spring of 2020 kind of shut down, you know, everything froze up and including deals. You couldn't do showings, all this kind of stuff. Everybody was kind of like, but then starting about mid 2020, it's like Montana was safe relative to the rest of the country, all these things. And then it caught up, you know, it dipped early 2020 and then well caught up for it by the time we were, sorry. Yeah. By the end of 2020 and then marched right into 2021, which was a record setting year.
I guess we have a little more to talk about with stigma. Going back to the IX, in my belief now, after seeing just crazy shit sell over the last 3 years, it reminds me of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies when those took off and Warren Buffett said that's the bigger fool. It's the only way you can win at cryptocurrency is the bigger fool. I don't know if you call it a paradox or what.
There has to be a syndrome. You're dependent on a bigger fool than you.
Yes. Yeah. The only way you make money.
A fool and you're only succeeding. You're only successful because there's a bigger fool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that way about the IX, but it doesn't cause me a lot of alarm and concern because I think, well, history has shown in the last 3 years that there is a bigger fool out there, that you're not going to be the one left holding the bag.
But, you know, back to Warren Buffett, I think part of the point is that you can't, yes, those fools and those deals are out there, but it's not exactly a business plan. It's not exactly a...
No, it's speculation.
Yeah, you can't count on it. Just because some people make a killing doesn't mean it's a...
So it's a gamble. It's speculation, yeah. I'm here trying to, you know, sell ranches, and I'm just trying to deliver my sales pitch right now. So everyone calls me.
Didn't you just say earlier you don't blow smoke up anybody's ass?
No,
you didn't say that. I didn't go that far.
I'm saying that if it is a gamble and if it's speculation, you're taking a futures position. I think the risk is, I don't think the risk is as high as I perceived it to be. Previously, that's the only way I can summarize that is, I do think that this gamble, this speculation, has a lower risk than previously assumed.
Well, we've talked about this in the past too. I mean, the risk is diminished greatly by holding time. Sometimes when I look at properties that I question the price, you know, it seems like maybe someone overpaid, right? One way of thinking that, well, they prepaid some appreciation was it. That's the extent of their risk and their exposure, because land appreciates virtually every year in Montana, historically. And so if you overpay a little bit, well, your first couple of years, maybe you're catching up, but especially if you're holding, you know, flipping is, you know, or short holds, that's another story. But most purchasers seem in the market to that have the intent anyway of holding for.
Well, and this ranch is being an alternative asset with a limited market, high transaction costs, everything we've discussed about quote unquote a broken market. I think you and I have gone so far as to say, well, it's definitely an imperfect market.
Imperfect, yeah.
Yeah, not broken because you have people like me. No, I shouldn't say people like me. It's not broken because you have me. I'm a participant.
You're so helping keep this shit together.
I am Atlas.
You and I are out here doing our best keeping this shit.
The weight of the world on my shoulders.
We're trying to make this market resemble. We're trying to make assertions and we're trying to interpret this market.
But normally you're not going to be able to be a flipper in ranches.
No, that's tough. That's tough. Yeah, that came to my mind earlier this morning in a conversation working for clients in the past that want to invest in Montana land and have a short hold time. That's tough.
Well, what do you see going for from here as we wrap this up? What's your crystal ball saying?
I think we're going to have this slow market for a while. I mean, transaction volume is way down. Inventory's down, and you know, it's kind of chipping, it's kind of rebuilding slowly.
Inventory is down from what?
Pre-COVID.
Okay, so
yeah, so today on the market, I believe, and we post these stats live on Montana Land Source, I believe today there's something like 360, knocking on 370 active listing properties, 200 acres and larger in Montana. Pre-COVID, that was 600 to 700.
Okay, so we are, was pre-COVID, was that like the all-time high of inventory and supply?
Well, it's a little tough because Montana Land Source was only going, you know, for a few years. I only have a few years. So I think, let me think this through. I want to say 2017. I think my data, 2016, 2017. So those three, that's only 3 years. But I suspect, I mean, I think it's grown over time because Montana, you know, has grown population and market activity, but not dramatically though. I think that 300 listings, I mean, you know, I just don't have the data going far back, but I don't think that's been normal for a long, long time.
Do you have what was the bottom, the absolute low supply? Probably like November of 21 was probably around the lowest inventory has ever been. So yeah, do we have a growth rate from then? Like, oh, is supply growing at 3% a month or is?
Yeah, I don't have it quantified, but yeah, it's been a very slow, because the lowest was December. I'm thinking this through. I think actually the lowest was December of 2022. I think the tail end of 2022, we dipped below 300. It was like 29 in the 290s. Cause I'd been watching that number. And it's funny the psychology around number, right? It's like, well, what does 300 mean? But it's like, wow, is it really going to get below 300? And it was dancing there. And then it did December. It dipped below 300 listings. And now we're back up to three, but that's not a big jump. It's still very, very slowly rebuilding. And you know, if more properties hit the market, are they going to trade? Is inventory going to truly build up? I suspect, I mean, your question moving forward, because I've wondered about this a lot, is this something that's going to correct and go back? You know, are we going to get back to a 600-700 level inventory, or are we in a new normal?
So, I mean, to make it relative, absorption rate must be extending currently. We are on a lengthening trajectory of absorption rate.
Yes.
Climbing from, let's hypothetically, 8 months on average to 9, 10, 11, 12?
Actually, days on market are still decreasing, I think. Our data is still showing days on market decreasing. So a lot of these properties that are hitting the market, potentially rebuilding inventory, are being picked up.
It must be A-grade properties.
Yeah, or price corrected. Properties that get price corrected. And actually, I kind of think a lot of the high inventory we burned through a lot of inventory in 2021, 2022. I think that was largely the higher quality stuff. So I think what's actually out on the market, and that's why I kind of hedge against saying that the market is down. Statistically, the data shows that values are down. But I think that might be reflective of actually lower quality properties trading. I think those properties are being price adjusted and trading, and there's such a low inventory and such a lack of supply. And so there still is demand out there for properties in Montana, but we were in a seller's market, and we're not. And I don't know that we're in a buyer's market, but the buyers have, the negotiations are taking place.
What do you do with the IX when days on market was 3,562?
That is why I use medians and not averages. Because that screws up your averages, your average. Okay. But median is, because our market being as imperfect as it is, has extremes. The data set has extremes, and medians work better when you have outliers than averages.
And acres wouldn't be a good form of analysis because that can be so widespread as well. Too many long tails there.
Yeah. Well, look at the Matador. I used to track, I do those annual, we do an annual event, every year.
Rupert Murdoch's.
Yeah, exactly. Huge, hundreds of thousands of acres like that. I used to track numbers of acres sold and try to make sense of that. And it's there's too much variance. There's too many outliers. And that's a consistent problem in studying this data it's even getting down to an individual appraisal, right? It's like, okay, here you got a set of sales and they seem to make some sense. And here's this crazy one. And it kind of begs a question. It's like, well, on the one hand, you can kind of easily throw it out. It seems to clearly be an outlier, but our market is impacted by outliers. Certainly. That outlier sure as shit affected the perception in that area.
Absolutely.
So, you can't, you're kind of bringing me back to some of these appraisal projects where it's like, you can't use it, but you can't quite throw it away either. Right?
Yeah. Well, so that gets into, maybe we should save this one for another episode. I think we should. Market makers. Are these ranches and some of these brokerage firms actually, I think there's reason to believe that they have legitimately reached the level and status of market maker.
Well, my mentor, Clark Wheeler, has been talked about as especially his dominance in the market, when I got started working for him, which was kind of, pre Montana Land Source, pre any of these sort of online data resources, that kind of thing. He was the oracle. And I know some people made that, I don't know if criticism is quite the right word, but that allegation that, he could say things that were,
influential.
Yeah. At what point does the reporter or the observer of the market become a market maker with what he says about the market?
He could pump and dump if he wanted to.
Yeah, right.
Well,
that's my goal with Montana Land Sources, to become a market.
Damn right. Now you're going to have more people mad about your blog posts and some of the things you say.
Right.
Well, let's do that one another time.
That sounds like a fun one. Yeah, market makers.
That is that's a deep one that we definitely can go on an hour.
Let's get the Murdochs and the Wilkes and some of those guys on.
Rupert Murdoch, not Alec Murdoch from South Carolina who murdered his wife and son.
Right.
Yeah. We could go to his prison cell and ask.
Ooh, Yeah.
Tell us about your ranch sale.
We want to talk about stigmatization.
I want to know how he chose which broker. Like, hey,
I see this as a niche.
Any other public notices out there that I should be?
It's a dog eat dog world, man. You gotta.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. I do have a call to action, an ask of my audience. And Andy, you might want to get one in there too.
Yep.
I definitely want to hear your feedback on this episode. So please leave me a message anywhere you see us, we, they, them.
Oh God.
the royal me. Just let us know what you think about this and how I can bring more effective content, what you'd like to hear about. I definitely want to have a mix of what you want to hear and the people that I find interesting. I don't find Andy that interesting, but he's convenient. So give me some feedback, please. Help me improve this podcast. Thanks for listening. Andy, what's your ask?
Yeah, my ask is basically just to go to mtlandsource.com, check out all we have, all the resources. We got a dynamic online map with every large acreage listing on the state mapped and pendings and sales. And we have live market statistics. So as soon as we enter a new comp or a new listing, that gets pumped right into those statistics and it tracks back going, you know, a year or two and whatnot. So lots of content. And yeah, same thing, like feedback on my site. And I mentioned, you know, a few blog posts, which I don't do enough of, want to do more of. That's something I'm interested in, is what kind of content and analysis could I be working on to put out that would be of interest.
I think you've been on this podcast so many times that it's worth it to just throw this out there and pitch it for you, Andy, and our listeners, is for you to host a focus group. If some of our listeners would want to spend 2 hours with you, or that sounds like a lot, but an hour.
Did we have a talk about my rates earlier? questioning my rates?
And you watch them navigate your site and ask questions and get their feedback, and you focus group your API.
Yep. I was part of that with a buddy, because, you know, I'm in the Rock 31 Center, which is a, you know, entrepreneur small business hub. And a colleague that has a tech platform, I thought this was genius. He invited us, a bunch of us, to his home and created a drinking game out of it, finding bugs.
There you go.
And I'll just say, I'm not going to go into the details of the drinking game. We didn't have to drink at all. Him and his developer were under the table within an hour. They didn't quite have the structure of the...
all the information we were hoping to achieve from this.
But I mean, the amount of bugs and information they got for the price of whatever they paid for the food and drink was pretty astounding. I mean, you really put it through the paces. And at that time, I said to myself, yeah, I need to do something similar, because this is fabulous.
Hit us up, audience. Let us know if you would do a product demo focus group with Andy and help improve Montana Land Source.
Well, but part of the issue is that what I shared at the start of it was bringing on some new tech partners so that I can actually make those changes.
Oh yeah, you got to follow through. That's, right? That is a challenge.
Yeah, and I'm really trying to bolster my tech partnerships to get that accomplished.
Well, just do like I do, write it down on a piece of paper. You know,
put it over there on the stack
somewhere in that mess. I'll get to it. I'll find it again. And yeah. Well, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, Coulter.
Ranch Investor Podcast. Bye. Listeners of the Ranch Investor Podcast who are receiving this immense value for free, thanks for tuning in. I do have an ask in place of advertising. I do not monetize this on Spotify, Apple, anywhere. I don't click the monetize button, so I do have to get a plug in here. And I ask, what I'd like from you is to hear some feedback. So on our social media, please share this episode. All I ask in return for not having promotions and advertising is that you share this, send a text, get it out there so more people can enjoy what we're producing. Thanks for tuning in.
We feature only the best accredited and established rural real estate professionals who analyze, transact, and manage billions of dollars annually. No newbies here. Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped.